I'm Kevin Kelly. The show's live and local, and my guest today is John Paul Buzard of Buzard Pipe Organ Builders, based in Champaign. And we'll be hearing about this old world tradition of crafting organs. And there are so many details that we can talk about, and we'll cover as much as we can and hear some samples of different types of organs, including, of course, some Buzard pipe organs. It's live and local here on FM 90.9. That was an organ concerto by George Frederick Handel, played here by Trevor Pinnock with his English concert, the opening of the third B-flat, the third concerto in B-flat, heard on this program, which is called Live and Local. It's your connection to local music and more. And we're focusing on the organ today, in particular, building of organs. My guest on the show for this hour is John Paul Buzard, who runs and founded the Buzard Pipe Organ Builders there in downtown Champaign. And I'll bet you most people did not know there was an organ builder in downtown Champaign. The giveaway, if you ever go by there, is you might see apartments that I think are called the Organ Loft Apartments.
Yes, that's correct, yes.
And that's the giveaway, but it's harder to tell that there's actually an organ builder in there. Welcome, John.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Thanks for coming in. Well, you know, this is a topic I don't know a lot about. I know a lot of people who know a lot about organs, and sometimes my eyes will glaze over when I get with organists or people interested in organs, and then they start talking organs, and like
nothing worse than being around organists talking shop. Let me tell you,
which they seem to like. You all seem to like to do.
Only thing worse is organ builders talking shop. Yes, exactly.
Well, and there, you know, there are organ groupies, you know, people who just love the sound of the organ, mm-hmm. and they'll go to every organ recital that exists. And then, of course, there are some people who just can't stand the sound of the organ.
There
and
are those. That's, yeah,
you know,
that's
it,
a shame.
It's sort of a polarizing instrument for some reason. Any idea why that might be? I mean, obviously you're a fan, but
well,
have you ever
I'm not
thought
sure,
about that?
Well, I'm not sure if it's that certain instruments that people have heard put them off of the particular sound. Maybe an organ that they heard was extremely bright and loud, and maybe they don't think that that's a very good sound. Or, on the other hand, maybe somebody's heard an orchestral-style organ where it's rather dark and opaque kind of sounding, and maybe didn't think that that was suitable for something they were trying to listen to or play. Or maybe the fact that organs are mostly installed in churches gives it such an ecclesiastical reference that maybe that in and of itself puts people off. Certainly when we hear on the radio an organ concerto and you hear other instruments with it, well, the organ is just having this delightful little part like in the Handel works. But it's a rare thing to hear solo organ pieces at all, whether on the radio or even in church on a Sunday morning. The literature is, a lot of the literature is needs a particular kind of an instrument to play successfully, or maybe just that much texture of that type for that many minutes isn't within our modern ability to sit and focus. I don't know.
Let's ask the other question. What do you love about the organ? Why did you get into organs in the first place?
I fell in love with the organ when I was five, and it was purely because there was this incredible sound. My father was an Episcopal priest, and his first parish in Chicago had the distinction of having a real bell in the bell tower and a real pipe organ. And the organist and choir master that was there at the time, who had been there for 52 years, a fellow named Albert Johann Strom, Northwestern University class of 08.
That's a wonderful name for an organist somehow.
It is. Oh, and he was a real mentor. He was something else. Well, he could just make that instrument talk. And it's not like it was an organ of particularly stunning pedigree or anything particularly wonderful about it. But it captivated me. I think probably the fact that it could whisper and it could roar, it could set an entire building in motion, basically, that you could feel the pew under your butt vibrate when this when low, low pitches were being played. The thing that really, when I was five, I just decided I needed to learn how to play. But when I was six, I decided that organ building was for me. And it was kind
of... At age six?
At age six. I kid
you
not.
And you're conscious of this?
Yes. Oh, very much. I was one of the youngest trebles in his Men and Boys choir at the time, the last of that kind of choir in the city itself of Chicago. And one Sunday, this organ ciphered. It started, a pipe just played, and I could tell it was... something was wrong during...
Meaning the pipe played and got stuck, and it kept playing.
It got stuck, and it kept playing, and I could tell something was wrong. It was during the sermon hymn. So my dad was, of course, getting ready to go in the pulpit, and I could just hear something was not harmonically right. And when AJ let go of the final chord, he dutifully turned all the stops off, but it didn't help. This pipe just kept playing and playing and playing. And so he motioned to me, he beckoned to me through his pince-nez at me in the chancel on the other side. And he got me across and said, well, you come upstairs, and I'm too old to get down this ladder, but do what I tell you, we'll fix this and it'll be all over with. And so we raced upstairs and opened the organ chamber door, and here I'm met with this hissing monster. It was, for somebody who's 6 years old and only a few feet tall, an 8-foot long organ pipe is gargantuan, but a 16-foot pipe is like you're in the middle of a forest. And of course, it's horribly loud because, you know, the organ is off in a chamber. And so I climbed down the ladder, and it was something very easy. It was like a piece of dirt in a magnet or something had gotten the note stuck. And well, I came out of there and I thought, ooh, I like this. I could do this. But, you know, I really, now I've seen what these look like, I really want to build them. And I want to be able to make instruments that are not only wonderful machines, because, you know, every kid loves to take watches apart and hopefully put them back together or experiment with this and that, things that work. But I really
usually restricted myself to disassembling a pen.
A pen.
just
well, I
record.
Did take a watch apart, but it didn't go back together altogether well, I'm afraid. But that's just... how I really got infected with this whole desire to build organs, play them. I apprenticed with a Chicago area organ technician during high school and first 2 years of junior college up in Chicago, Evanston area. And my dad, now at that point, the retired Episcopal priest, when he heard that I wanted to be an organ builder, said, well, John, you don't really want to work for the church. There's no money in it. That's why I retired early and I'm working in the private sector. Mm. And I thought, well, what else could I do? And he said, well, you know, you write well. You're reasonably articulate. Why don't you try journalism like I was before I became a priest and like your mother was? And I thought, well, okay. So I enrolled here at the University of Illinois in radio, TV, journalism, and was one of the last people to graduate from the radio TV course here before they dropped the curriculum. But after that, I missed playing and I missed working on organs. And I thought, well, I'm only 20-something. Maybe I could really do this. And the way to prove myself was by learning at a university level how to play the organ, how to develop a technique, how to play literature, see what the instrument really was all about. So I enrolled as a freshman all over again here at Illinois and studied with the late Gerald Hamilton, who was the organ professor here at the time. After 2 years of that study, I auditioned at Northwestern and was accepted in the master's program. So I tootled up the interstate and worked on that degree for 2 years. By the time I was finished, Jerry Hamilton at Illinois wrote to me and said, you know, the practice organs haven't sounded so good since you've left. Why don't you think about coming down to the University of Illinois as a full-time organ technician?
Would you tinker with them when you were here?
Well, actually, I left something out. They had given me a tuition waiver in trade for taking care of the practice organs. That little bit of apprenticeship that I'd had with the Chicago organ technician put me in good stead doing that. So I came down in 1980 and took care of the instruments, rebuilt all the practice organs, got the recital hall organ up to snuff, and now have a private business, and that's what I've been wanting to do all along. We do take care of the organs at the university. I built 1, 2, 3 organs for the School of Music.
These are small practice organs.
Small practice organs, yeah. And so here I am hanging out my shingle. I've got 15 really wonderful guys that work with me in our little place downtown. we thankfully, thanks be to God, enjoy a really fine reputation throughout the country in what we build and the instruments that we rebuild and restore and take care of as well.
So that's been, how long ago did you start the business?
Oh, well, I suppose professionally it would be 1980 when I came down here to the university. Concurrent with my work at the university, built an organ for First Baptist Church in Savoy. They used to be downtown, and that church moved to the suburb. And they dismantled their organ and put it in a storage shed and said, okay, John, what would you build with this? And I had this great opportunity to build them a new organ out of the old parts and some new things that we had to have. That happened in the garage. And then a little organ for a Methodist church, the Methodist church in Homer, was built in the dining room. It got to the ridiculous point that an organ that we built for St. James Methodist Church in Danville, the large organ, 70 ranks, 70 sets of pipes on 4 keyboards, big organ, was built in the basement of our house. It's the sort of corollary as building a boat in your basement. How do you get it out? Well, you know, you build things in small sections in that case, and there was a lot of on-site labor in the installation and building of that organ. But that's when I really realized, and when we got a commission to build an organ for the Episcopal Chapel here on campus, that's when I realized I need a real shop building. You know, I need a place with a tall ceiling so we can actually set the thing up all at once. Maybe even, if you're lucky enough, play it in the shop before it goes to the church. I bought that building. It used to be the Women's Town Club of Champaign at 112 Hill Street. Bought that exactly 20 years ago last May.
Wow. So we will talk about some of the details of organ building.
Oh, sure.
Because that's some of the fascinating.
And I hope your eyes won't glaze over.
Well, no, because we're in a controlled setting here.
Absolutely, you know? You have the switch.
I have the switch, and besides, I knew we were going to talk about this, and I thought it'd be interesting. Sometimes when you're sitting at dinner, and I don't know if I want to talk, because sometimes organ conversations, they get to be sort of little clicky kind of conversations.
They do get very specific, about certain schools of organ building or certain schools of organ literature, and how I did this main note trill when I played here.
Right, things I don't know about, but see, we're here to find out about it. So
sure.
There we go. The piece that I introduced you with, I guess we could say, was a Baroque concerto, and one of the many recordings you brought along, and we certainly won't get to all of them, but we'll see what we can get through to give an idea of different organ sounds. You brought another Baroque piece. This is dances by a fellow named Heinrich Scheidemann, four Alemans. We'll hear 3 of them. What do you want to say about Baroque organs in general, or about this one in particular?
Well, this particular organ is a Taylor and Booty organ, Taylor and Booty are modern-day organ builders, but they're building organs in a very, very traditional way.
And where are they based?
They're in Virginia.
Virginia.
Right by Stanton. Build instruments in a North German Baroque style, and very, very authentic. And so I thought this might be interesting to hear a 21st century take on what 17th century music and 17th century organ building is like.
So they did mean this to sound as much as they could make
it. As very much possible.
As at the time of this composer, which is 1599. So this is all kind of pre-Baroque, really.
Mm-hmm.
Heinrich Scheidemann, a few Alemans, played by organist James David Christie here in Live and Local on FM 90.9. That was organist James David Christie playing 3 Alemans, technically from what's called the Suzanne von Scholt manuscript of 1599. We don't need to go into the technical aspects of that because I don't know them anyway. On an organ built by a Virginia-based company called Taylor and Boody, Boody, at the College of the Holy Cross. Where is the College of the Holy Cross?
I believe it's in Worcester,
Massachusetts. And that was the voice of John Paul Buzard, who is in charge of Buzard Pipe Organ Builders in Champaign. I'm Kevin Kelly. This is Live and Local, and we'll continue that conversation here. It's a very different sounding organ in just a moment, very different kind of music. Support for our show today comes in part from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods on the corner of 6th and University in Champaign, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of foods from around the world, including cheeses, olives, spices, hot sauces, olive oils, and more. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio. Whether it is a Baroque-style organ, such as we just heard, mm-hmm. One where, as you said, is trying to come as close as possible to the sound of an original Baroque-era organ, 1600s, 1700s, and so on. And we're going to hear, coming up, a rather large, romantic-sounding organ. What are the similarities? What goes in, what are the parts of an organ that, all people just see? The console, mm-hmm. which is the thing you play from, mm-hmm. the keyboards, and people are familiar with stops.
Mm-hmm. The little knobs you draw. Mm-hmm.
That expression,
pull out all the stops. That's exactly
in
right.
In case you wondered what that comes, this is where it
That's
comes
That's a pipe
from.
Organ phrase, yes.
And then, of course, people see some of the pipes.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. The similarities between a Baroque-era organ and a modern organ, or an even Romantic-era organ, would be that they all use wind-blown pipes and that the keyboards are similar. But that's about it. That's about it. There are so many technological differences in how you actually get the key to play the pipe. There's an evolution of organ building that started out Baroque, pre-Baroque, where basically the key that an organist pressed would directly open a valve that would allow wind to enter a pipe and make it play.
By some direct attachment.
A direct mechanical linkage between the key and the valve. And that is, those kinds of organs are being built today. The Taylor and Booty organ is one example of a tracker action organ. In fact, the little sticks of wood that pull the valves down are called trackers, hence the name tracker action.
They must be rather long.
They can be. But the difficulty is that if you make them too long, the action becomes unresponsive. Not so much in the time that you actually depress the key to make it play, but the repetition that you're able to give to a note. Because there's a certain amount of inertia to that kind of action, and it takes a while for the action to go back to rest. So repeating a note, you can't repeat a note terribly quickly on a mechanical action organ. As musicians, as compositional styles developed, the organ developed technologically as well into the classic and then the romantic period, where to fill vast cathedrals with sound and to actually make their sound a little bit more orchestral, to make the sound a little bit more in keeping with the orchestral instruments as prototypes, organ builders found that if you play the pipes with a little higher wind pressure, and if you change or you manipulate the way in which the pipes are voiced, that you can get an energy to the sound that a Baroque organ doesn't have in and of itself inherently from pipe to pipe. That even, this is going to sound kind of unusual, but even when a pipe is playing relatively softly, you can fill a room with sound if it has a certain kind of an energy in its voicing. And that's really how the Romantic organ developed. But the difficulty is, if you have the organ playing on a higher wind pressure, the valves become more and more difficult to open. And so tracker action in and of itself caused organists to really have to almost do weight training in order to be able to depress the keys enough to get the organ to play. So various assisting mechanisms were invented, pneumatic assists at first, and later in the 20th century, electricity helped assist the organ action. And it's when electricity became not a fad anymore, but was actually usable and reliable, that the electric action pipe organ really came into its own. And the one builder in the 20th century who was the greatest proponent of electric actions and of an unashamedly orchestral approach to the organ's tonal resources was a fellow named Ernest M. Skinner. Boston, Massachusetts. He's responsible for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of organs before his company was taken over by the Aeolian Organ Company, becoming the Aeolian Skinner Organ Company. And I brought a CD along of a fellow named Ken Cowan, who is an organ teacher at Westminster Choir College, who is a young proponent of rediscovering a style of organ playing of orchestral transcriptions. That is really what E.M. Skinner himself wanted his organs to play. He didn't want his organs to play Bach. He wanted to just sort of stretch the bounds, and he used technology to do that, the technology he had available at the time.
And this sample, well, I'm not even going to introduce this sample because I'm willing to bet that most listeners will recognize the music, but they probably didn't imagine it could be played on the organ. This is an organ I've actually heard a number of times. This is the 1921 Skinner organ at the Parish Church of St. Luke in Evanston, Illinois.
Right.
And as you said, Ken Cowan performing here on Live and Local. So I said at the outset that that's an organ that I had heard a couple times myself, at least a couple of times. The 1921 Skinner organ at the Parish Church of St. Luke in Evanston, Illinois. And I have to say that the sound engineer, captured the sound pretty much as I remember it, and which is this deep, rich, dark, sort of distant sound.
Mm-hmm.
And John, you were telling me off mic here that... that's part of the intentional design from E.M. Skinner to be able to create an orchestral sound. And, of
yes.
course, the piece was, in case you were wondering, name that tune, The Ride of the Valkyries from Richard Wagner's opera Die Walküre, and played here by Ken Cowan. This is Live and Local on FM 90.9. I'm Kevin Kelly. My guest is John Paul Buzard of Buzard Pipe Organ Builders in Champaign, Illinois. And so that's the polar opposite of that Baroque music.
Precisely.
We heard earlier.
Yes, the polar opposite would be accurate, yes.
You know, we can go so many different directions in this conversation. I know we're going to go in a minute to your specific ideas of what an organ should sound like, or at least what your organs
mm-hmm.
sound
sure.
like in general. But I'm looking at a picture of that Baroque organ that we played earlier, and I'm recalling to mind, and I guess this is a drawing here of the organ at St. Luke's in Evanston, much of which you can't see.
Yes, that's right.
But one of the beauties of so many organs is the casework. You know, you see the pipes,
mm-hmm.
and many of those pipes play. Sometimes people do decorative piping,
yes,
don't they?
Indeed. Mm-hmm.
And then you do the casework, which has to be an incredibly complex aspect of building an organ.
And it actually, the case is an important musical component of the organs that we build, and for example, the Taylor and Booty organ. Part of classical organ building encompasses several things. The action, or your choice of action.
When we were talking
about
trackers, the mechanical
or
tracker,
electric action. Mm-hmm. But it also, classic organ building, and the classic organ building that we ascribe to, also implies a number of mechanical things, which I won't go into necessarily here, the kind of ways that the valves are opened, the kind of valves that they are, how the organ gets its wind. All of these things are important components to creating ultimately a sound. But the case is an important aspect because not only is it an architectural statement visually in a room, whether a church or a concert hall, great, but it focuses the sound. That's why, for example, Baroque organs, where they're playing on relatively low wind pressure, that's how they can fill a room with sound, because they are being made as acoustically efficient as possible. Whereas, for example, an E.M. Skinner organ is perfectly well at home in a deep, deep recessed organ chamber off to the side of a church, fronted by maybe two dozen big zinc organ pipes, many of which play, some of which probably don't. That's a real difference between the styles of organ building. And as you said earlier off mic, that the Skinner organs that you've heard sound distant. Mm-hmm. Even when you're close to them, they sound distant. They sound dark. And that's it. That's part of the reason.
You mentioned when you were talking earlier about the tracker mechanical action and so on, mm-hmm. and made several references to creation of the wind. Where does the wind come from?
In modern organs, wind comes from electric blowers, basically a fan inside a housing that revolves very fast. That produces compressed air that is then trunked through the organ, and the pressure of which is regulated by various reservoirs, or bellows, as they would call them in the old days. Now, the Taylor and Booty organ is such an authentic copy of older styles of organ building that they actually have hand pumping mechanisms in the back of the organ. And if you have a very, very good friend who doesn't mind pumping the organ while you practice, you can get a different kind of feeling out of the winding system. You have to realize that you can't just hold a chord on full organ with two pedal notes at the same time without running the organ out of wind.
So you've got to have somebody back there pumping the thing.
And in an organ like the Taylor and Booty, you have to know how to play the wind system as well as play the notes and the music.
Wow.
Now, in a modern organ that uses a typical electric blower, you can play a 12-note chord and two notes in the pedal or three in the pedal until, you know, the cows come home, and it just won't matter.
And
or until the electricity
it.
Goes
yeah.
off, and it will continue to sound, hopefully, without going out of tune. Yeah.
That's one of the curiosities I've always had about organists who, and maybe this is the reason, because they can. You know, you come to the end of a hymn or you come to the end of a piece and they will just hold that last note for an eternity.
I know it. I don't understand that either. Because the last note, you being a musician and a conductor would understand that the last note of the piece, they don't all have fermatas over them.
No.
They have time values. And if you're retarding into a particular tempo, well, that last note value ought to be consonant with what's happened before. But to hold, you know, the final chord for a long, long time, I guess that's to signal to folks that don't know, oh, that's the end. I guess it's time
well,
for
but
me to applaud.
I think it also must be just because they can. Because you have an orchestra. You can hold
you can't
it
do that.
Indefinitely. The strings could play indefinitely. They could just keep sawing away. But wind players are going to run out of wind.
Yep.
Just as that an early Baroque organ will run out of wind unless you keep pumping it up. The only way you can pump up a wind player is
a circular breath or something.
And then you have stopped. Mm-hmm. You have stopped playing. We're talking with John Paul Buzard of Buzard Pipe Organ Builders here on Live and Local. I'm Kevin Kelly. And, you know, I don't know who's going to be on tomorrow's show. I was thinking of announcing, as I usually do, who's going to be on tomorrow's show, but I don't know yet. So listeners will just have to be in suspense, as I am. We've got a couple of interesting possibilities, and we'll let you know later on this afternoon. I know you brought along some samples of your own organs, and we have a sample next of a recording that was an inspiration for your organ sound.
Yes. When we were commissioned to build the organ at the Chapel of St. John the Divine here on campus, that particular Episcopal church has a very well-established traditional Anglican music program. And that means that it requires a lot out of its pipe organs, whether they're small organs or large organs. And one of the touchstone services that the chapel offers to the community is Advent lessons and carols. It was a tradition started by Jerry Hamilton when he was there many years ago and continues to this day under my wife's leadership.
And your wife is Linda Buzard.
Linda Buzard, yes, indeed, organist, choir master there. And so this organ had to do that Brit lit, had to do English literature very well, but also has to be a vital American organ. But there are certain kinds of tone qualities that the English organs have that a Baroque organ doesn't have, a French Romantic organ doesn't have, and frankly, a Skinner organ doesn't have. So when I got the commission to do the chapel organ, I basically played the record of Advent lessons and carols from King's College over and over and over until I wore the poor LP out, researched English organs as best I possibly could, and visited with English organ pipe makers as well, and visited a number of churches, always kept coming back to the sound of King's College because it's not turgid and leaden. It has a real life to it. The reeds are clangy, and they've got a really great sound, but it's still an accompanying organ, which all of our organs really are. They are meant to accompany choirs and hymn singing.
It's kind of fun that you've. This is now the second organ you've chosen that I have heard.
Nope.
Because I was at King's College once during an evensong, wonderful English tradition, with the choir there. And
it's an experience you'll never forget.
I'll tell you, the aspect of that I will never forget. It was totally embarrassing. They were recording this for a radio broadcast. Mm-hmm. And right in some silence or another, I dropped my hymnal.
Oh, and it was you, was it?
It was, yeah, and it landed flat, the worst possible way, flat on the hard floor and made the most incredibly loud sound. But this is a very different sound indeed. This is a hymn, Merton.
Hark, a thrilling voice is sounding.
From King's College, the Advent Lessons and Carols service. Do you know what year this was, though? Any idea? Do you
remember? I believe this was recorded in 1968.
And the organist, any idea?
It was Simon Preston when he was a little boy. He was the organ scholar there, and
no
Sir
kidding.
David Wilcox was the conductor. Well,
the conductor, King's College Chapel. Here on Live and Local on FM 90.9, particular attention to the sound of this organ, because you may hear
You'll hear bits of it later.
Mm-hmm. In a little while. I was caught by surprise there. The track continues, but that's actually one of the lessons from an Advent Lessons and Carols service at King's College, Cambridge, in England, from the 1960s. Simon Preston as the young organ scholar, and Sir David Wilcox. I don't know if he was Sir David at that point or not. But
I don't know. I don't know if he was.
He
or not.
Did become leading the choir of King's College, Cambridge, in their annual Lessons and Carols service. And that piece, that sound, that organ sound, the inspiration for one of the early organs of John Paul Buzard, who is my guest here on Live and Local.
Thank you. It's something about all of our organs, and it started out with the chapel organ, is that they're accompanying organs. They're really meant to be able to text paint the words that are being sung with the sound that the organ's making. So as you noticed in the Merton hymn, so the lamb so long expected. Before that, you hear the little gathering tone, and it's the organ is really pretty light. But then when you get to the verse of, so that last when he comes in glory and the world is wrapped in fear, well, that's when you bring all those huge swell reeds on and behind the swell box, and the organ just, it's not loud, 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 but it's a really full, almost raging sound. And as you open the swell box a little bit at a time, as the text is going on and the world is wrapped in fear, you know, that's really telling you this is something really big. But then, may he with his mercy shield us, is the next phrase that follows. So you notice that Simon Preston turned all the reeds off so that the sound calmed down completely. That's how you can really make hymn singing, for example, or even anthem accompanying, really come alive. And not every organ can do that. You have to have enough variety of color in the organ's tonal palette and a wide variety of volumes, even in a small organ, to be able to do that. One of the tests is if even a small organ can make a seamless crescendo and diminuendo without you really noticing that you've drawn stops. You know, that's kind of the litmus test for a really excellent accompanying organ.
When you say drawn stops, meaning you've pulled out more.
Right, right. As you engage more and more ranks, you don't hear them sort of come in all at once. You notice that the organ's getting louder and bigger, but by means of operating the expression pedals and doing a number of things, and the fact that the sounds are voiced in certain ways, that you're able to do that.
Just a couple of questions of terminology, things you were talking about there. The swell box.
Ah, right. That's something the Brits invented. Clever folks. In order to have the organ's volume gradually change, either get softer or louder, we place an entire division of the organ behind what are called swell shutters. They're in a case within the case, for example. And within that case, the front of that swell box is made up of louvers, which can open or close when the organist operates a foot pedal. These shutters is what they're called, are very thick, 2 inches thick, basswood. So they're dense enough that they, when they're closed, the sound of the pipes that are inside that box are soft to our ears outside. But when you open the shutters, they gradually open, then the sound gradually swells, which is why it's called a swell box, why it's called the swell division. And then you hear it louder in the room. So if the organ is voiced properly, and if you're a sensitive organist, what you can do is have some fundamental kinds of sounds on the great organ, the bottom keyboard, which is typically in an organ case is not enclosed in an expression box. And you can add stops to the swell with the shutters closed, and you can't hear them come on. But when you open the pedal, then the organ begins to get louder and louder. Well, once that organ begins to get louder and louder, you can add more stops in the unenclosed part of the organ, and you won't hear them come on. Close the swell back. The volume hasn't changed. Then you can add the big reeds in the swell so that you now hear a color change when you open the expression box. Then you hear the color change, and the organ gets louder and louder. But gradually, it's very smooth, kind of a crescendo that way.
So, in case anybody wondered whether organ playing was just technically just a matter of learning to play the keys,
notes. Mm-hmm.
It's all of these other aspects you have to learn if you're going to do it well. And actually, some organs you can see the swell box very mm-hmm. easily. I'm thinking mm-hmm. of two in Champaign, and I think they're both. One's in Urbana, both made by the same company. The one at the Smith Music
Yes,
Hall.
Yes, a Cassavant organ from 1965.
And the one at First Methodist Church in Champaign.
Also a Cassavant. In fact, they were installed within 2 months of each other.
No kidding. But you can know I've seen them both, and you can see
you
these
can
things
see the
very
shutters.
Easily.
Sure.
The other question I wanted to ask you about, you referred to reeds. So the stops, each of the stops, the things you can pull on mm-hmm. an organ, to change the sound, each of those always has a name,
mm-hmm.
often but not always named after an orchestral instrument.
Oftentimes, yes. There are basically two generic kinds of organ pipes. There are what we call flue pipes, which are like whistles, where it's a column of air that vibrates. But reeds make their sound by a brass tongue that actually vibrates inside the pipe. And it's flue pipes. Well, then, those two generic classes of organ pipes can be divided into four families of sound, just like orchestral families of sound. There are diapasons, or principals, which sound just like organ pipes. They don't purport to sound like an orchestral instrument. There are flutes, and there can be all kinds of different flutes, depending on the construction of the pipe, the material the pipe's made out of. Then there are strings, which, if you use your imagination and imagine strings being blown by wind, well, they kind of have similar overtones to real strings.
But I'll bet you that's one of the more problematic sounds to create in an organ.
Extremely. Those are very difficult to voice. And then the reeds can be trumpets, oboes, clarinets, trombones, tubas, any of the brass section or woodwind section of an orchestra.
And some of the tuba pipes are humongous.
Yes, tubas are particularly the largest commanding solo voice in an organ that we would build. They're played on extremely high wind pressure, and it's a very dark sound. It's a very loud sound. You can hear that solo over full organ a lot of times. And in fact, in the chapel organ, there is a tuba. And I think it's probably the first tuba that was installed in a modern American organ since the 30s or 40s.
Really?
And this was 1991.
And that was in a small space.
In a small space.
A space that is not quite as small now.
Thanks be to God, it's not as small as it was. The chapel was started in the pre-Depression months and was stopped as soon as the Depression hit. And we've now finished the building with an additional, we've added about a third of volume to, the space. Yeah. And it's all hard stone walls and hard plaster so that the sound really does have a chance to reverberate in the building. Hymn singing is through the roof. People can hear themselves sing. They don't feel like they're singing a solo, and so they don't get timid about making some sound.
And to remind folks what we're talking about and who we're talking with, this is Live and Local. I'm Kevin Kelly, and John Paul Buzard, my guest of Buzard Pipe Organ Builders, and the chapel to which he is referring, and we're about to hear this organ that we've referred to a number of times, is his Opus 7, his seventh organ, at the Episcopal Chapel of St. John the Divine in Champaign, Illinois. It's actually on the campus of the University of Illinois, mm-hmm. corner of Wright Street and
Armory.
I always forget which, right by the University Library, as a matter of fact. And so now, as I'm seeing that our time is nearly at an end, it should be just enough time to hear this wonderful anthem by Charles Wood, O Thou the Central Orb. It's the John Paul Bizard organ at the Chapel of St. John the Divine. And this is a guest choir, Christ Church Cathedral Choir of Men and Boys of Indianapolis. Frederick Burgermaster, is he the organist on this performance?
No,
this
he's piece? Not. A fellow named Alistair Reed was their organ scholar, so he's playing and Fred is conducting.
Conducting. And, well, let's listen to it. And if you remember the sound of that last organ from King's College Chapel, you might hear
You should hear a little similarity to it, I hope.
All right. The John Paul Bizard organ at the Episcopal Chapel of St. John the Divine in Champaign, Illinois, played there by organist Alistair Reed. And the Christ Church Cathedral Choir of Men and Boys of Indianapolis was a guest at the chapel at that concert. Frederick Burgermaster leading the choir in Charles Wood's O Thou the Central Orb on Heard here on Live and Local, and my guest this hour has been John Paul Bizard himself.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure. There's so many questions we didn't get to because the organ is such a vast instrument. It's always been astounding to me the power one must feel as an organist, because you can just sit there and just make all this sound.
Yeah. And you can be a little scrawny kid, and you can make all kinds of sound, and just have to learn as you get older, maybe. Just because, let's say you own a Maserati, you don't have to drive 100 miles an hour to the corner to get a loaf of bread.
But you can
play. But you can.
Yeah, there you go.
Discretion. Playing softly once in a while is always appreciated.
John Paul Bizard of Bizard Pipe Organ Builders, based in Champaign, Illinois. And it's been a pleasure to have you. Thanks very much.
Thank you.